probably bump into the other vehicles up there. Didn't do any damage, but it came close. So look out for ice. There was another thing I was going to discuss with you, Paul. Oh, yes. In the case of the SNAP, however it's pronounced, where it's going to be doing soil moisture radar mapping, turns out that one of the projects that Airborne Instruments Laboratory had, I can't remember the fancy long abbreviation for it in the acronym, but it was a kind of a satellite that was going to operate at a whole bunch of radiometry, radio frequencies, radio astronomy type frequencies, where it was going to look down at the atmosphere at 30 gigahertz, 60 gigahertz, 127 gigahertz, and so on, and by measuring what's called Stokes parameters. Stokes parameters is this guy, George Stokes, way back in 1860 or so, discovered that if you, let me wait for the beep. He discovered that if on either a radiometry passive measurement or in an active radar measurement, in either case, if you measure all of the polarimetry parameters of the signal being emitted by that layer of the atmosphere or that layer of soil, you're looking at the right-hand and left-hand circular polarization, and the horizontal and vertical polarization, and the phase angle between the two. You put that all together as what's called Stokes parameters, and you properly process it. You can figure out what is the dielectric material, whether or not the dielectric material that you're looking at, soil or atmosphere or cloud, how much moisture does it have, whether or not the particles of moisture, like raindrops, for instance, will have certain chirality characteristics. It's a fancy way of saying that you aim a radar signal at a raindrop. The raindrop, because of the quasi-tear shape, it's not really tear shape, but it's got a crazy shape because of the aerodynamics of that raindrop coming down through the air. Therefore, it has different reflectivity characteristics to a horizontal or a vertical polarization. The raindrop cross-polarization characteristics is the main reason that your microwave satellite dish will sometimes give you a dropout on a rainy day. You would think that the rain is creating absorption. That's not it at all. Let me drop it. It is the non-symmetry of the raindrops that creates cross-polarization coupling. That satellite you're looking at with your satellite dish receiving system has a bunch of transponders, you and I would call them channels, but a bunch of transponders, and a particular satellite, all the odd transponders are clockwise polarized, and all the even-numbered channels are counterclockwise polarized, and they have frequency overlap, so this gives them frequency reuse. A small number of megahertz allows them to squeeze in twice as many channels by this cross-polarization overlap characteristic. However, when those multiple signals come out of that satellite, go through a rain cloud, which has not completely symmetric raindrops, which creates coupling between the clockwise and counterclockwise waves, the net result is that your satellite receiver thinks it's on transponder number 3, which is clockwise, we'll say. It's simultaneously getting some leakage from transponder number 2 and 4, which are the other sense of polarization, being coupled in by way of raindrop characteristics. And pretty soon the satellite is not getting a 30 decibel carrier to noise ratio. It's getting something much less because of the cross coupling of the rain, and the thing drops out and says, it'll give you an indication of low signal strength. It ain't the low signal strength, it's high bit error rate. So your satellite system, when it drops out because of rain, is not because of absorption. So as you can tell, various materials, let me drop, like soil with certain amounts of moisture and certain kinds of crops, and clouds with certain kinds of moisture at certain altitude levels, where the raindrops are in ice crystals or melted water or so on, the Stokes parameters, properly evaluated, can give you a lot of other hidden information. It's even beyond holography, so to speak. There's a lot of information buried in that radio wave. If you've got the right kind of smarts, you can suck that information back out And I wonder if anything like this was mentioned when what you've read so far on the SNAP experiment that's doing soil moisture radar mapping, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, the SNAP mission is, yeah, they use the word map and they put an S in front of it, you know, so it's soil, moisture, passive, you know, active, passive satellite, you know, so they work hard to get these acronyms, but that's what it is, SNAP. And, yeah, I did read that because of cloud cover here and there, what they needed was a real wide swath as this thing goes across, because that cuts back on the chances of hitting clouds. You know, if you're going to hit clouds, you know, part of it won't be hitting a cloud. And this way they can cover that same part of the Earth every 2 or 3 days and get, you know, accurate measurements. And to do that, they need as wide as possible. And with this 20-foot diameter dish spinning the way it's spinning, it's going to create a 620-mile-wide swath as it goes across the Earth, and they'll be able to tell the difference between the freeze-thaw type of thing. And, you know, you say, well, frozen, you know, the signal's not right, you know, but you get totally different type of signal. They'll be able to tell how many, you know, inches are wet. But they can tell by the way the signal comes back if it's frozen or not. So they want to know that information, and then they're going to see it, you know, if it's thawing within a certain amount of time or of days, they're going to get an accurate picture of the moisture level on the whole Earth. Back to you, Dave.
Looks like we're not getting beeped anymore beyond 11 o'clock. I think that's the way the machine works. You talked about the refurbishing of Launch Pad 39A at Cape Canaveral, Florida. And you guys have probably heard my my crazy story of way back in 1971. I went to Cape Canaveral and purchased one of the antenna positioning devices, Scientific Atlanta Model 5323, I think it was. This was an AS over L over AS positioner. Rated for, I think it was rated for 5,000 pounds of holding and 5,000 foot-pounds of bending moment. And the one that I bought had been used for making antenna pattern measurements. I'm not sure if it was Gemini or Apollo, but one of the other of the space capsules had been mounted on that pedestal. They were no longer using it. I purchased it from them. I went down to Florida to my contact guy, who arranged this whole arrangement with me when this thing became surplus. And that pedestal was in my backyard for a while. I was going to use it for a great big radio telescope experiment, and for a bunch of reasons that didn't come about. And I now sold that to W4RX, who now has that pedestal. Anyhow, let me drop.
It had to be 39A. Gemini and Mercury will launch from different complexes.
Okay, so it had to be Mercury, 39A. I know that it was
Apollo. It had to be Apollo.
Yeah, I know it was Apollo then. And I know it was on 39A that I was at. And the reason I was at 39A is because my contact down there said, hey, you'd probably like to see the actual launch pad. So he drove us up to the launch pad. And we walked up that very long ramp, and we're looking at the launch umbilical tower and so on. And we were, let me pick a number, 1,000 yards away from the front gate. And we were there probably starting at 3 in the afternoon, and he was walking us around, showing us all kinds of stuff. And around 5 o'clock at night, the guard came along and locked the front gate. He didn't know we were up on top of that ramp and pedestal area. So we come walking back down, trying to get out, and we run into a locked gate with barbed wire on the fence on the top. And lucky for us, did he have a cell phone? No. In 1971 is when this occurred. There were no cell phones then. There must have been a local telephone alongside of that gate. And he went and called the guard shack, and they came along and unlocked the gate for us. So unlocked the chain link fence gate. So I got locked. I got locked onto launch pad 39A, Paul. I think I've told you guys this story about three times. One of the exciting things that happened to me while I was down there. So that launch pad has seen a lot of history. Apollo got launched from there, and I think quite a large number of the space shuttles got launched from 39A. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, including the first and the last one, and then some of the other ones were done on 39B. So yeah, both were set up for the launches. You know, you had the rotating service structure on both of them, and that was built for the shuttles. That wasn't there for the Apollos, but that was able to bring in different cargo to be loaded onto the space shuttle at that location. You know, incredible piece of work. SpaceX was going to disconnect that rotating structure, but now they've changed their mind. They're going to leave it there. And they're just going to launch their heavy Falcon 9s with that place. They're going to rework it, resupport it, and do different things. But that's going to cut back on the time. They need to get this done the latest by June. They want to be able to do their demonstration flight. So you're going to have, first big commercial rocket going off from there. You've got your Apollo missions and space shuttle missions that all took off from those platforms, the 39A and B. In this case, it's 39A, and SpaceX, they bought it outright. They're working on that, just like they have the other one complex down in 41. That they use right now for their launches to the space station and also for commercial work. Back to you, Pete.
In the case of the space shuttle, I do remember Owen Garriott from space telling us over the radio link that round numbers, 4 million pounds of mass on takeoff, roughly 6 million pounds of thrust, when you add together the two solid rocket boosters and the other orbital engines on takeoff. I think you told me that Apollo had something like the launch vehicle there had something like 7.5 million pounds of thrust, the Saturn V. And when it comes to these new fairly large vehicles, SpaceX and others, roughly how high in million pounds of thrust do they have on takeoff, if you happen to know, Paul? I like these big numbers. WS2N, K2RIW.
I have trouble remembering them. I'm pretty good at it. I know the shuttle is 5.5 million pounds of thrust. The Saturn V was 7.5 million pounds of thrust. For the moon rocket, and don't forget the Saturn V also put up Skylab. So that's a 7.5 million thrust rocket. And now you're going to have the SLS coming up, the Space Launch System, and that's going to be 10.5 million pounds of thrust. So, and there's two versions of that. There's the 70-ton cargo version. That'll be the first one to be flying, and then as time goes by, they'll come out with 135 ton, or they call it metric ton, rated SLS mission. And both of them will be more powerful than the Saturn V. And as far as SpaceX goes, I think it's 1.5 million now on the Falcon 9 deck. And then, once they have the heavy one, that's like three of them, three times that amount for the Falcon Heavy deck. That's going to be launched probably this summer.
So the biggest number you've given me so far, Paul, is 10.5 million pounds of thrust. Now, one of the things I like to do is to convert that into horsepower, and there's a bit of a problem. If you're pushing your automobile in order to get it to a gas station because you've run out of gas, you're applying a certain force through a certain rate. In other words, you're pushing the car at, pick a number, 3 miles an hour, and you're applying a certain amount of force. And so that speed combined with that force can be converted into horsepower. And as Brian Allen found out on the case of the Gossamer Condor, the thing that could fly a figure eight course or a variation of it, flew across the English Channel. A very athletic, good pilot, automobile, human being named Brian Allen, he could turn out a little bit close to a third of a horsepower for something like 15 or 20 minutes. A world-class athlete could do that. If you push against the wall of your house and the wall doesn't move, you're burning up a lot of calories, you're applying a lot of force, but if the wall doesn't move, the horsepower that you're generating, in theory, is zero. Let me drop. So when you apply the force, it's got to be across a distance at a certain rate in order to convert it into horsepower. So when 10 million pounds of thrust is being exerted by a takeoff rocket, because the rocket hasn't moved yet, from one point of view, the horsepower is near zero. From another point of view, it is moving air at a ridiculously fast rate. You can come up with a much higher horsepower number once you know how fast the air is moving. Once the rocket gets into space and starts moving, now it becomes easier. Now, you're talking about 10.5 million pounds of thrust. Let me drop. The turbojet slash ramjet combined engine that's on a SR-71 that flies that vehicle at Mach 3.21 at 80,000 feet. So you're moving at 3.2 times the speed of sound, and each one of those engines is not generating millions of pounds of thrust, it's only generating a mere 35,000 pounds. 35,000 pounds of thrust is still a fierce amount of thrust. However, it's doing it through air at a ridiculously fast rate, 3.2 times the speed of sound. You go through that calculation, 3.2 times the speed of sound, and 35,000 pounds of thrust, and the answer is 200,000 horsepower. That thing is chewing up fuel like you wouldn't believe. However, that particular very specifically designed engine by Mr. Ben Rich when working with Kelly Johnson on that airplane, that engine gives you the highest possible miles per gallon when it's flying at 3.2 times the speed of sound with full afterburner. That's when it gives you the best miles per gallon. Crazy engine. And to me, 200,000 horsepower. I wonder if the Queen Mary comes close to that. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I don't know. What has that got two big diesel engines in it? I have no idea about the ships, Dick. Just the rockets. And you mentioned Owen Garriott. Of course, he was one of the people that not only flew on the space shuttle, but flew on Skylab. And his son, Richard Garriott. So that he was the first American, second generation astronaut, if you think about it. And, he went up as well. And they were both hams. But he's got quite a story, too, Dick, if you've ever heard Richard Garriott's story.
If I know Owen Garriott, who's a ham, W5LFL, or K5LFL, I think it's W5LFL, in theory, I talked to him on Space Shuttle number 6. Well, it wasn't a good two-way conversation. He could pick my call letters out of the rabble of thousands of hams shouting at him simultaneously. So in theory, I got a QSL card from him for a QSO, because he could pick my call letters out of the tape recording, out of all that noise. And I was blasting with him four Yagis on 2 meters aimed at the space shuttle, and I think I was running 300 watts of power. 300 watts afterburner, and 4 Yagis aimed at him, and I just barely climbed above all of those thousands of hams shouting at him all at once. Anyhow, I am guessing that his son Richard is also a ham radio operator. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I don't know what his call is, but he was an astronaut, in, not in the sense of, you know, one of the guys with the right stuff. He was the guy with one of the guys with the right money, and he became like a billionaire, this guy. So he got a ride on the Soyuz up to the space station as one of the space tourists, but he put a lot into doing it, you know. In fact, they turned him down in the beginning because he had some kind of a medical problem. So they, you know, he took a chance on, he had to do something with his liver or something. So he's got like a 20-inch gash in his body that the doctors put in there to work on, do whatever they had to do. And it was a life-threatening operation, but he did this just so he could qualify at Star City to go through the training to blast him up, blast himself up to the space station. So, interesting character. Back to you, Dick.
So technically speaking, Owen Garriott, astronaut, has a son who technically is an astronaut because he paid for the ride, but he wasn't one of the people approved by NASA as a official astronaut. Is that true, Paul? And when you pay for that ride, and you go up to the space shuttle, I guess you're up there just until the very next vehicle that goes back down. On average, what are you there? A couple of weeks? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
I know he was there 10 days, so some of them are longer, some of them are shorter, but he had a good run. And, no, NASA has to approve him. You know, he's going to the space station. He's going to our home. But naturally, the Russians have to approve him as well. He's got to make certain qualifications. And anybody that gets above that 60-mile number, that 100-kilometer height, whether it's, you know, our country or another country, you know, you're considered an astronaut once you do that.
So he is an astronaut, a cosmonaut, and what is the Chinese equivalent? What word do they use, Paul?
They call themselves takanauts with a T. So, I don't know if they I don't think they give him the cosmonaut name. I think they give him the astronaut name because he's, you know, he's American. But, who knows? Maybe, I don't know what they do with Mark Shuttleworth. He was from South Africa. I don't know. I call them all astronauts, back to you, Dick.
Okay, without a doubt, he flew above 62 miles, 100 kilometers. He was in space. He's an American, so he's an American astronaut. But he flew on a Soviet vehicle to get there. In my mind, he's also a cosmonaut. He can use either one of those, or both. Alrighty, any further questions for Paul on the subject of space, space vehicles, Launch Pad 39A, Apollo, or Cape Canaveral? You've got any further questions, give us your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Let's watch out for New Horizon next year. It's going to actually start taking pictures of Pluto They consider the beginning of that mission in January. January 14th is considered the beginning, even though they're a long way. You know, they won't get right on top of it until June. But, you know, it's going to investigate that planet and its moons before, during, and after.
So January of 2015, essentially 2 months from now, I'm guessing it wakes up from a sleep, starts taking pictures of Pluto as it approaches. And the actual real flyby of Pluto is that June or July of 2015, Paul. That's going to be an exciting mission. Over to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, beginning of June,
beginning of July, I think it was. I don't know, it all dates my head, but I think that's what it is. But whatever, we'll look at it as time goes on. But yeah, this month, not this month, this coming year, January 14th, it'll start taking pictures. And they're going to wake it up at that time, a little bit before that. And it's only been asleep, I think, I don't know, 60, 70 days or something. I think it went to sleep in August. It's gone through hibernation, I think, about 7 or 8 times since launch. So, and you know, each time it wakes up, they check out all the equipment, take pictures, make sure everything works, and they're going to do that again this time around. But it should be good. It's got 5 moons to investigate, maybe more. Maybe more will show up as this thing gets closer.
That's amazing. It's a tiny little planet way out there with 39 astronomical units called Pluto. 5 planets going around this planetismal. We used to call it the planet Pluto. It's been downgraded, but it's got 5 moons. 5 moons, round shape. And you're in my mind, Paul, that fulfills all the requirements of a planet. I think the only reason they downgraded it is because they're starting to discover a whole lot of other things in the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt, which are similar in size to Pluto, and they didn't want to start racking up all of those things where we went from 9 planets to 40 planets around the sun. The solar system, from their point of view, is getting too complicated. I am guessing because of those other things they were discovering. That's the main reason they downgraded Pluto. Other than that, Pluto is big enough to be round, got a large enough gravity field that it's got its own planetary, its own satellite system of moons, and I guess, is it really controlling the space it goes through and sweeping up everything? I think it is. But it does have an unusual orbit compared to the other 8 planets, which I guess in some people's minds means that it maybe didn't form from the original solar system cloud. Let me drop this. It might really be a captured object. So I'm going to ask you for your opinions on that one, Paul. And however, once New Horizons flies by Pluto, we're going to know what it looks like. We're going to know whether or not it's got a magnetic field. We're going to know something about its rate of rotation. We're going to know something about its inclination of its axis of rotation compared to the ecliptic, the plane of all the planets in the solar system. You got any guesses as to what they're going to see, Paul? What magnetic field, what tilt, what angle, what direction of rotation, what color of surface? Is the surface outgassing? What are the moons like? You have any guesses, Paul, as to what we're going to see 8 months from now? WS2N, K2LIW. Let's see if you're a betting man.
I think they're going to find more moons. I think they're going to find they're going to find surprises because, you know, they're not only going to photograph the surface of Pluto, they're going to photograph the, like, for instance, the surface of Charon, biggest moon that goes around Pluto, and a couple of the other moons. I want to see the surface of all of these and see if they're similar. But, you know, I know they've got a lot of magnetometers on board and all kinds of neutral apex spectrometers that they're going to, you know, tell what the planet is made out of and all of that. But I'm more interested in seeing the pictures personally, of course. I want to see if they have any geysers on the planet, similar to what they found on the moon of Triton when they investigated that. Triton goes around Neptune. Drop it. And I think Pluto might be, something of that nature, you know, because that moon goes in the opposite orbit than everything else. So they figured that was a captured thing. Pluto looks like it was a captured thing. Like you said, it's got a pretty elliptical orbit. It's also, I think, a couple of few degrees, 5 degrees or something, out of the ecliptic, so out of the ecliptic plane. So should be interesting. And then on top of that, they've already got a couple of other bodies that they're looking at in the direction that New Horizon is going. So this way, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, they'll be taking more pictures of some other body out there. But I'm amazed. When you know, we listened to the Rosetta story, and that thing was at a little over 300,000 miles out, 300 million miles out. So that's three times the distance of the sun, and I'm fascinated that pictures and everything are coming back from this thing, from Rosetta. And that's it. If you think about it, it's 3 AU. That's three times the distance of the Earth to the sun. And here this thing, New Horizon, is out there already at 39 AU. You know, 10 times the distance of where Rosetta is to the Earth now. And that's going to be taking super close-up pictures of Pluto. That's incredible. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I'm guessing at the speed of light, the communication round trip to New Horizons and back is probably something like 10 hours. So if in the beginning of that mission you see something happening, you want to apply some corrective action, you're looking at very old news on the signal you just got. What's the rough guess, Paul, as to how many miles an hour, with reference to Pluto, Horizon will be moving? Sort of a whiz by as I see it, and you got a real conflict of interest. You got a finite number of minutes when you're up close. You want to measure as much as you can of the Pluto surface. You want to measure as much as you can of the five moons. Maybe they're not going to bother measuring all five, but boy, is that a conflict of interest here. The guys who really study moons, they're going to want more pictures of that. The guys who study planets and magnetometry fields, they want the camera aimed at Pluto itself most of the time. So the close encounter is how long and how fast will it be moving at that time. I'm a little bit afraid the answer is going to be it's going to whiz by at 4,000 miles an hour. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I don't know what the approach speed is. I know it. You know, on the way out of the solar system, you're looking at 32,000 miles per hour. So, but you know, because Pluto's also going around the sun, so it's going to be slower than that. It's going to be pretty quick. But since they're going to be taking pictures, long distance pictures, starting this January, you know, you've got, you know, as the months go by, they'll get better and better resolution for whatever they're doing. So you're probably looking at, you know, a month before and a month after a very good quality, you know, imaging that's going to be going on. Of course, that last, you know, everybody's going to want that last hour. Back to you, Dick.
And here's another guess, Paul. On the best day of Hubble making a measurement of the moon, of Pluto, it's kind of a fuzzy picture. At some particular time or distance of New Horizon from Pluto, it has the ability to take a higher resolution, better picture of Pluto than Hubble ever did. What's your guess? 1 or 2 months before encountering Pluto, it has exceeded Hubble's ability? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
On the resolution of the cameras and the telescopic capability of those cameras compared to the Hubble, you know, how many, I think Hubble had 5,000 megapixels in the original CCD, and you know, you probably got a million on this thing, you know. So the difference is, you know, it's going to be in the engineering. My guess is you're going to get, if I had to take a guess, you're going to have better pictures probably 3 months out, 3-4 months, you know. Already, they did take a picture 2 months ago of Pluto. You could see Pluto and the moon Charon with the, you know, in one picture. And, you know, now you're already 2 months closer. They did, you know, I did see a picture of that. It looked pretty good. You know, you couldn't tell. I mean, it just looked like, you know, actually it looked like a double star, binary star system. Back to you, Dick.
35, Paul. Thank you. Fascinating stuff. John, I know, let's start the process of the mailbag. I got a little bit of a hint because John called me this week. He gave me a heads up as to what's coming. Some lady that we know very well from Limock named Kay, he's going to tell us her call letters and her question. She has an innocent sounding question. You wouldn't believe what depth there is to that question if you decide to go into it. And maybe we'll start scratching the surface tonight. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, we can give them some titillating information. By the way, before we start, I wanted to give you some information on the Queen Mary, which I read a little bit of the history of Queen Mary many years ago. What a wonderful ship. It was capable of carrying 16,000 troops in the Second World War. Fastest vessel on the water at 30 knots. Submarines couldn't catch it, couldn't get it. It was a zoo. But unfortunately, the captain was given specific orders. He was never to stop the ship for any reason. Well, when he got to around Ireland, where the British Navy was, there was a British fast frigate, may have been a destroyer. He cut it in half. 237 men were killed. The captain was saved, and quite a few men recovered by other vessels, but he had to maintain his course. No speed change, no course change. Can you imagine that? So 80,000, I think it was 80,700 tons approximately. He started in 1930, the construction, and was one of the finest vessels ever made. The compass on the ship was the largest ever made, the heaviest shockproof compass. The ship has a lot of history, Dick.
Okay, I think you're telling me that he slowed down to half speed, and did he get fired upon? Is that what you're saying? I should know, but I don't. And didn't the ship get sunk, Paul? Here we go, John.
No, Dick, he was not allowed to slow down. He was not allowed to stop. He cut the British frigate in half. He did just, you know, following orders. That's the way it was during the war.
Wow. Was there a fog involved? Was there improper steering, improper communication? He cut the frigate in half and just kept right on going with no further damage to his rudders, propellers, bow, or whatever. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, just kept on, maintained speed, maintained course, just like he was told, followed orders. And there was some minor damage to the ship, which they did back in where it was built, I think Scotland, they took care of that. But that was one of the things that happened during the war, very sad. But because of the U-boats, although they couldn't catch the Queen Mary, you know, if she stopped, of course they could get it. But that was how critical it was. And with 16,000 men, they were not going to take any chance. And she could maintain 30 knots at 80.7 tons. Incredible.
Now, as long as he keeps moving 30 knots, and if he's a perfect straight line, you would think there's a possibility of anticipating where he's going to be when and sending a torpedo in that area. Therefore, if he does a little bit of steering to go around that frigate, he's not violating orders per se, he's not putting the troops at risk, but he's saving the people and that frigate. I'm a little bit amazed that he couldn't steer a little bit left or right, or he couldn't communicate with the frigate saying, hey, 5 minutes from now, you better steer hard left or I'm going to be hitting you. Over to you, Paul. John, K2LIW.
Dick, I think the frigate turned hard helm and crossed his path by accident. And the thing with a ship like the Titanic, if it would have hit the iceberg head on, there would have been much less damage to the ship. So that was part of the consideration. If he would have sideswiped him, it's possible he could have damaged the ship and would not have, completed his tour. So that's all part of what a captain has to consider. So it must have broke his heart to do that, but he was following orders. Yeah, no way he could change it.
And I think you're telling me the bow of the Queen Mary is a very strong structure, that it can slice through things. Whereas you rip something along the side, and you get another Titanic sinking possibility. Wow. And how many guys were on that frigate that died, Paul, John?
I believe it was 270. Could have been 273, somewhere around that. It was a long time ago I read that story. But most of them were saved, from what I understand, by other vessels that were around in the area. But that ship, like I said, didn't even slow down. Can you imagine having to do that as a captain when you're running over, it's not the enemy, your own people. Even if it is the enemy, it's terrible.
No guess as to how many horsepower are in those engines on the Queen Mary?
No, I don't remember. I don't know if that was a turbine design or like diesel piston. I'm not sure. But in 1930, I don't think it was diesel, but I'm not positive. I can find that out. That'd be interesting. I know I read it, but I don't remember it.
So 80.7 thousand tons moving at 30 knots. I think you and I could make some rough guess as to the amount of water resistance. We know the speed. We know the weight. We can estimate the water resistance. We can estimate the draft of that much weight. Therefore, we could make a rough guess as to the horsepower. Was the Queen Mary, rough numbers, 1,200 feet bow to stern?
I believe she was 1,000 feet, just a hair longer than the Titanic.
Okay. I think Titanic was built in the shipyard at Belfast, Ireland.
Yes, both of them were built in the same place.
So they were both built in the same place, Belfast, Ireland, and you gave the shipyard a particular name. What was that name?
I think it was Harlan.
Dick, I have a horsepower from the internet.
Fire away, Paul.
Was it turbine or diesel?
Diesel, they ran four 16-cylinder diesel engines, combined total, they show 90,100 RPMs, 514, that's pretty much it, as well as two General Electric gas turbines on the Queen Mary II, which provided another 40,000 kilowatts, or the equivalent of 67,000 horsepower. Back to you.
Okay, so I think the last number you gave us, 67,000 horsepower. Is that correct, Paul?
Now I'm talking about the Queen Mary 2 here. I don't know if there was a Queen Mary 1, I guess. That's the one you were looking for originally. Queen Mary 1 is showing 160 horsepower total. How could that be more? If that's older. Wow. No, they're showing 67,000. No, wait, I'm wrong. 90,100 with the four diesel engines, and then an additional 67 horsepower with the two additional General Electric gas turbines.
67,000, 64,000 additional?
Yeah, that's what they're showing. Well, they're turbines, you know. I'd like to see, which one are you really interested in, the Queen Mary 2 or 1?
I believe it was Queen Mary 1 that participated in the Second World War. I think it started construction in 1930, so I don't think that would be QE2.
Oh, okay, yeah. 882 feet long is the Titanic, where this thing was, the Queen Mary was in a half that. Not half. Whoa, wait. What do we got here? Overall length. Queen Mary is just over 1,000 feet. Titanic is less than that, 882 feet.
That's what I remember.
Horsepower for the Titanic, 46,000. Horsepower for the Queen Mary, 160,000.
Okay. So around 160,000 horsepower for one of the Queen Marys when it's flat out, and one engine on the SR-71 is cranking out a little bit shy of 200,000 horsepower, and there's two of them on board screaming at around Mach 6 exhaust velocity, I'm guessing, but the aircraft itself is moving at Mach 3.2. A lot of steam there. And because just the air hitting that aircraft, that whole surface is running somewhere between 400 and 600 degrees Fahrenheit, you can't put your hand against that windshield. You'll burn your hand. So they got one hell of an air conditioning system to make sure that the pilot doesn't get cooked in that oven. That's a lot of energy coming out of that thing. And so, when you read some of the stories of the pilots who flew that, two of the most exciting stories are, one, when you use the periscope that's on board at night, and you look rearward, and you see that flame shooting out of the engine, out of the back of those two engines. I don't know the exact number, but I think the flame is something like 100 feet long. It must be an exciting-looking thing. It's like standing on top of a rocket, if you know what I mean. But these are ramjet, turbojet engines. The engine was a turbojet at low velocities, and it starts becoming a ramjet at high velocities. Very exotic engine. Let me drop it. And one of the more exciting events occurred when they were doing a test run near Los Angeles on a particular day where a Cessna pilot wasn't sure about his air velocity, so he calls into the local traffic control center, flight tower, whatever you're going to call it, control tower, and say, your radar shows what speed, and I think the answer was 80 knots. And then some a guy with a dual-engine Cessna aircraft comes on there with a very authoritative voice and says, how fast am I moving? And the answer was 160 knots. And then an Air Force pilot flying, I think it was an F-15, but I'm not sure what it was. He decided to join, and I asked, how fast are you? What does your radar show I'm moving? And I think the answer was 450 knots. And this was a golden opportunity. These two guys on the SR-71 are in that airspace. And I said, hey, Center, what does your radar show for me? And the answer was 1,825 knots. To which the pilot on the SR-71 says, yeah, that's close. Maybe I've got a little bit of error. My instrumentation shows 1,900 knots. After that, I hear tell that that channel went silent for the next hour. People just sat there and thought, What the hell was that? Over to you, Paul. That's on KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yeah, the military has some wonderful instruments to use. You know, it's just a shame they're meant for war. You know, another interesting thing, if I remember correctly, the Iowa-class battleship, of course, it weighed more, but that could maintain 30 knots. They were never used what they were built for. They never really fought other battleships, but they had a lot of action, especially the Jersey. And just think about that huge ship moving at 30 knots. How many miles do you think it took to stop that boy?
Yeah, I think in a case like that, you could turn off that engine and glide for the next 2 hours, and you'd be down to 10 knots, you know, numbers like that. The amount of kinetic energy of, what's the number now? 80,700 tons. That amount of mass moving at 30 knots, that is an irresistible object, no matter what the hell it hits. Can you imagine if somebody made a mistake and that went roaring into a shore at a dock? What kind of damage that could do? I suspect that that ship would still be moving when it's halfway across the town. What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Oh, without a doubt, Dick, I've seen the ships coming in very gently, just about moving, and they hit things that you think could not be broken and just crush it. I've seen the, you know, the ships get dented up pretty badly, but yeah, that's an incredible amount of weight to be in motion. And yet, when they're out in those big seas with 70-foot swells, they get beat up, and the decks are awash, but they keep going. The amount of power those ships have is just incredible.
Do any of those modern passenger ships have canards on the side, which gives them a little bit of control of the rocking motion of those waves? John, go ahead.
Yes, many of them do. They also have steering pods, which are forward and aft, where they do not have to rotate the main props. They can just rotate those pods and cause them. That's why they don't need tugboats. They can actually come in under their own steam now, which you couldn't do that with, like, the Queen Mary. That had to be brought in with tugs.
It looks like we're not going to get to our subject tonight. There's only 5 minutes left. That's not even worth a tease. Although, you could read the subject matter. Therefore, people know what's going to be coming next week. We're going to be discussing Kay's subject. What was Kay's subject, John? I'm having some fun with him. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2LIW.
Dick, as you know, wonderful woman to speak to, and has eclectic interests between animal husbandry, astronomy, all this science type of stuff. She's great. And interesting, very interesting to speak to. Now, she asked a great question, which we've never really broached as a subject on a TechNet, which was interferometry. And her question was basically, what is it, how is it used, what's the difference between the optical range and the RF range, what information do they glean, why is it an advantage? There's so much to learn, as I learned from you the other night when we were speaking about it. So I think it's a great subject, and I'll tell you the truth, as I believe you mentioned, we won't be able to cover it in one night, and I think it's going to stimulate more questions. So I think it's going to be a great subject, interferometry.
You got a slight mispronunciation there, John. You pronounced it interferometry. Most antenna people call it interferometry. So it really is the interreaction, so to speak, between two separate antennas, two or more antennas. So when you place two or more antennas side by side at a specific distance, you get some huge advantage in antenna performance of that combination called interferometer. If you were transmitting with an interferometer, your output of your transmitter would go into a power divider. usually two equal length cables come out of that power divider and go to the two antennas. Depending on what you're doing, there's a very desirable spacing between those two antennas. They're both aimed in the same direction, but they've got a common horizontal bar between them. The middle of that horizontal bar gets mounted to some kind of a rotator, azimuth elevation rotator, but usually azimuth rotator. And so how long could the spacing between those two antennas be? In the case of the best radio telescope that we had until recently, which is really a combination of radio telescopes, you might be using the one in Honeysuckle Creek, Australia, simultaneously with the one in Socorro, New Mexico. I don't know the exact distance, but they might be separated by 6,000 miles. Can we drop? And you could, for a radio telescope measurement, aim both of those antennas at the same star system. Those two antennas are, let me pick a number, 6,000 miles apart with a turning Earth. So if you make some very careful measurements, in the old days it was done with video cassette recorder, nowadays I'm pretty sure it's done with CD-ROMs, you make a very careful measurement of exact time, exact amplitude, exact phase of what you see at each site, and you bring those two CD-ROMs together at a processing center. You now have some of the resolution, even those two antennas are, in my example, 6,000 miles apart, great circle path, or, I don't know, as the crow flies, right through the Earth, it might be 6,000 miles apart. So you're getting some of the resolution of a radio telescope, 6,000 miles in diameter, even though all that space in between is not filled in. You could call it a partially filled phased array. And the ALMA millimeter wave telescope that recently went online at the European Southern Observatory in La Salina, France, La Salina, Chile. If you've seen the recent picture done by ALMA, let me drop it. We only got a minute or so left. Altacoma millimeter, submillimeter array. I forgot the exact number, but I think it's something like 60 individual parabolic dishes, something like 50 or 60 feet in diameter. And the outer perimeter of that array is something like 15 kilometers apart, running at something like 2 millimeter wavelength. When you put that all together, that recently made a picture of a solar system way out there. I don't know the exact distance. Maybe it was 20 light years. But it took a picture of a solar system in the process of being birthed. Right now, it's a cloud of dust around a recently formed star, and you can see aisles of streaks of missing dust where a planet is in the process of forming, and it made that picture for the first time we've ever seen anything like that. Okay, this was TechNet number 1531. You just heard one of about 10 things that an interferometer can do. Next week, we're going to go a little bit deeper into interferometers. They're at least as exciting. 12:01 a.m., 7:03, and good night. Interferometer is at least as exciting as a directional coupler. So you'll be hearing about that next week. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. And see you next week, KC2WGB, K2RIW. Bye-bye for now, and over to you, John.